You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO, at 102.7 FM.
Following the recent uprisings in London and other British cities, the British government has declared an all-out war on gangs and gang culture. The government is currently making plans to broaden the use of U.S. suppression models of policing, including civil gang injunctions. As part of this initiative, Prime Minister David Cameron has hired the so-called super cop, William Branton, from the United States. William Branton is a central character in the development and implementation of zero-tolerance policing. Isaac Ontivero is the Communications Director for Critical Resistance. It's a U.S. national grassroots organization working to abolish the prison industrial complex. Isaac joins me from phone in Oakland, California. Good morning, Isaac, and welcome to Vancouver Cooperative Radio.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
When we say zero-tolerance policing, what does that mean?
Well, I think it means a few things that are connected. Zero tolerance policing is something that was instituted kind of formally in the mid-1980s and kind of came out of this social theory of quality of life, or what they call the broken windows theory. And as far as police experts and theoreticians were concerned, their idea was that if you took a zero tolerance approach to small property crimes, vagrancy, public urination, these sort of things. If you took a harsh approach to those sort of things, that there would sort of be a trickle up in the quality of life. I think that zero tolerance police, and so it instituted kind of a suppression model of policing, or continued a suppression model of policing in which you control the movement and behavior of people in order to get a certain or a desired wider social response. Zero tolerance policing also related to and grew out of anti-gang policing and war on drugs policing. So where you had quality of life policing that was kind of attacking what we would call small behaviors, that was intertwined with very harsh policing, but also using a zero-tolerance approach against, so-called gang violence and also drug crime. And the zero-tolerance element of that looked like a heavily militarized policing in combination with a zero-tolerance approach in the courts, so that you would have indescribably long sentences for very small drug-related crimes. You would have here in California, for example, a third felony could get you life in prison without parole.
So your organization, Critical Resistance, obviously opposes this this approach. What are your critiques of this model?
Well, I think there's a few different critiques of this model. I think that this model, once again, if we look at it as if we look at suppression policing, we see that it is about controlling the ability of communities to basically move, and community members to move. And so what it does is that it targets certain people based on certain behavior. And over again, whether it be in New York or Los Angeles or Oakland, and now we're talking about London, is that that behavior is often categorized, or who fits the mold of that behavior time and time again, happens to be people of color, it happens to be poor people, it happens to be people that are already living under incredible economic and social marginalization. So the reason why we oppose that is we see it as a continuance of policing used to maintain an inequitable social and economic order. I think the other thing, and the other reason to oppose it, is that it takes away millions and millions and millions of dollars of resources from things that could actually go to increasing the quality of life of community members. Policing is very, very, very expensive, and it draws away from community-based approaches to addressing harm, to changing situations in neighborhoods, so on and so forth, that actually do work, that don't rely on violence, that don't rely on imprisonment. We've seen since the 1980s, since the kind of formal institutionalization of, you know, zero-tolerance policing, one of the effects of that we've seen is the tripling of the prison population in the United States. And so to us, having, nearly 2.5 million people locked in cages in the United States has an incredibly devastating impact on communities.
Is it the case, I've heard some statistic, the effect that there are more black Americans in jail today than there were slaves at the height of the Jim Crow era?
Yeah, I believe that's the case. Right now, there another statistic to think about. I mean, if you look at statistics as far as imprisonment, things get pretty bleak. You know, 1 in 100 adults is imprisoned in the United States. And that doesn't include young people, who are locked in youth facilities, and it doesn't include people who are locked in immigrant detention centers. The vast majority of people imprisoned in the United States are people of color. 1 in 36 Latino males between the age of 20 and 34 are imprisoned. That in that same age range for black males, the number is 1 in 9. So the racial disparities in imprisonment, and if you look at who's targeted by policing and see how those things are related, the racism of both the systems of policing and system of imprisonment is pretty apparent.
So now we have the Prime Minister of Great Britain calling for adoption of this American, it seems American-generated policy of zero tolerance and suppression policing. But how different has the UK been from America in previous years?
Well, I mean, that's an interesting thing, and I think one of the ways that's helpful for me anyway to think about it is, in the same way that, corporations trade and, import and export, if we think of the U.S. and the U.K., we can think of, rather than the kind of U.S. or the U.K., passively accepting U.S. policing models, we can see like an interplay. We can see a trade in information. We can see a trade in technique. We can see a strong relationship between these two governments who have investment in policing their way out of social and economic crisis. I mean, in the United States, we've seen the importation of UK police models. A lot of the stuff around gang injunctions actually came from antisocial behavior civil suits from the UK and were implemented in the United States in the form of gang injunctions. The UK has its own history around zero tolerance policing, going way back into, the 19th century, and they'd had these things that they called sus laws that referred to suspected person laws, and it was this idea that, if you fit the description of a what they would call a vagrant or a suspicious person, that you could be stopped and frisked and, even imprisoned at any time. And those laws ebbed and flowed up through the 20th century, and you see them used in what we would call here as racial profiling in immigrant communities all over England. And actually, the violence of that type of, suppression policing model in the UK actually led to uprisings in several cities in the early 1980s. So I guess my point is that they talked about bringing William Bratton, one of the kind of main political forces in zero tolerance policing, over to the UK. And certainly William Bratton has traveled the world sharing different police theories and strategies. But I think a lot of the these governments, whether they be the U.S. or the U.K. or governments all over the world, especially when they have their back up against the wall, especially when they are interested in maintaining a you know, terribly inequitable economic order or social order, they're going to start to share police strategies and technologies because they have the same concerns and the same fears about the discontent of the people living in their countries.
Prime Minister, British Prime Minister Cameron faced some criticism when he proposed apparently that he wanted to make William Bratton head of Scotland Yard, and somebody in his own cabinet said, no, we're not having any foreigners as head of Scotland Yard. That was the extent of the criticism from within his cabinet. But has he faced more opposition and criticism in England with his effort to highlight the style of policing and the reputation of William Bratton?
You know, what's interesting about what you just said too, and I think it's really interesting, is that opposition. And I'm sorry, I'm less familiar with British politics, but that the person, or that, you know, the people that opposed Bratton because he was a foreigner also didn't oppose his style of policing, and that they were very clear. They said, oh, well, you know, not Bratton because he's not British, but sure, let's have draconian curfews, of course. Let's have gang injunctions, of course. So I think that, unfortunately, and we see that here in the U.S., most certainly across, you know, whether or not the politician is, you know, liberal or right-wing, that in these moments of crisis, too often the politician's sense of creativity, sense of history, just flies out the window, and instead they start beating the drums of being tough on crime. I think that there are people all over the UK, like there is all over the US, and community-based organizations, or just average, you know, working people, who are saying, you know what, no, this isn't going to work. I think one of the interesting things around the uprisings that happened in London just this past month, or last month rather, is the people themselves who were uprising were talking about the roots of why they were in the street. They were, you know, we have to remember they were initially in the street in response to the police murdering an unarmed young man. But they would also, they went on to articulate the reason why they were in the street was the lack of access to jobs, the devastation of austerity measures, the lack of access to education, so on and so forth. And those are the same things that we hear of people here in Oakland, or I'm sure up where you are. And so I think that while governments are slow to respond, and when they do respond, they often respond in the interest of maintaining the same order that is causing so much discontent, I think regular people are interested in a different response, and are interested in, I mean, obviously people, I don't think, want to put their lives and bodies at risk, and, you know, get out into the streets and so on, unless they are really at their wit's end, unless they are really interested in some sort of change. And I think the thing here is, if we look at the North Africa and Middle East this past spring, if we look at the UK, if we look all over the world right now, we have people that are kind of rising up in different ways but making a lot of similar demands. And I think they're rising up amidst crisis, against, you know, global economic crisis. They're rising up against the increased violence by those in power, you know, who often use police to maintain order, and are saying, we know there are crises, we know that times are hard. What we'd like is a different way. We'd like more decision-making power. We'd like a shift in priorities. And I think even some of these young people that were out there in London were definitely articulating that same thing themselves.
Well, on that positive note, well, thank you very much for joining us this morning. I appreciate it a great deal, Isaac.
Thank you for having me.
I've been speaking with Isaac Ontiveros. He's a communications director for Critical Resistance. They work to abolish the prison industrial complex in the United States. And if you'd like to have more information about Critical Resistance, check out their website. It's criticalresistance.org.